Okay, this week's parsha is Parsha Shlach Tav Shin Ayin Ches. Welcome, everyone. And we will start from the beginning, page 798. Parsha Shlach, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Aleph. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Lema, Hashem said to Moshe, saying, Shlach Lecha Anashim, send for yourself forth people. You should send out people, the Asuras Eretz Canaan, and they shall spy out the land of Canaan. Asher ani noisein levnei Yisrael, that I am giving to the Jewish people. Ish echad, matei avayisav tishlachu. A man for the tribe of his father shall you send. Konei Sibraham, each one being a prince amongst them. So here is where Hashem is telling Moshe about sending the spies. So the very first Rashi, famous Rashi, deals with the question as to the juxtaposition of the end of last week's parsha to the beginning of this week's parsha. The end of last week's parsha deals with the story of how Miriam spoke against Moshe Rabbeinu, criticizing him for separating from his wife. And now Hashem punishes Miriam for speaking Lashon Hara against Moshe by equating him to other prophets when Moshe Rabbeinu was on a whole different level and therefore made the right decision. And now, after that, we have the story of the sending of the spies. So the top Rashi begins, Lamanismacha Parshas Meraglim Parshas Miriam. Why does the Parsha, the portion of the Meraglim, why is it next to the portion of Miriam? And the answer is, Lafi Shaluksa al Iske Dibosh Nibra Ba'achiha. Because she was punished for speaking negatively about her brother. Rishayim Alalu Ra'uv Lalukhu Musar. And these evil people saw what happened to her and did not take a lesson from it. And they themselves landed up speaking Lashon Hara. They saw Miriam speak Lashon Hara about Moshe and what happened to her. They should have taken a lesson from that in regarding how they would speak about Eretz Yisrael. Now, the commentary of Sifrei Chachamim cites two explanations as to what was bothering Rashi here, that Rashi was telling us the juxtaposition of the two parshias. Is it every time, does Rashi, at the beginning of every parsha, talk about why the end of one parsha is next to the beginning of the next parsha? Every single parsha, Rashi doesn't do that. So what exactly here was bothering Rashi? So one explanation that the Sifrei Chachamim brings down from the commentator of Rabbeinu Eliyahu Mizrahi, commentator on Rashi, is that based on Rashi in Devarim, these three stories, or these three parshias that we have Balaischa with the story of Miriam, we have Shlach with the story of the Meraglim, then we have the next parsha after Shlach is Korach, the story of Korach. So if you look at the way the Torah has it set up, you would think the chronological order is Miriam, Meraglim, Korach. But based on Rashi in Devarim, it should actually be Korach, Miriam, Meraglim. Because Korach took place in a place called Chatzeres. Miriam was punished in Chatzeres. And the end of last week's parasha reads, V'achar nasu ha'ameh Chatzeres, after Miriam was able to come back, after her tzaras was healed and she was able to return to the camp, V'achar nasu ha'ameh Chatzeres. And afterwards, the nation traveled from Chatzeres by Yacharu Midbar Paran, and they encamped in Midbar Paran, which is where the story of the Meraglim took place. So I'm not sure exactly, come to think of it, how do we know that Korach was before Miriam, but that seems to be the assumption. That Korach, that's what the Sifrei Chachamim, the Rabbeinu the Mizrahi says. You have Korach in Chatzeres, you have Miriam in Chatzeres, and you have Meraglim in the next place after Chatzeres. So why do we have, basically, Shlach next to Balaischa with Korach afterward? We have the Meraglim next to Miriam with Korach afterwards. We should have Miriam next to the Meraglim and Korach. Why is it only Miriam next to the Meraglim? That's what was bothering Rashi.
Can I also add something? I thought that the Torah was not originally broken up into parshas.
It always was.
Always was?
Yeah. There was always a division of.
Only after the destruction of the temple that they did that.
No, I mean, maybe it depends how, but just think about it. But the point really is, you know, the end, if you're going to say Fatara, right, there are breaks.
Right.
So the breaks definitely signal different sections.
I've heard this too. that.
Yeah, it may not have been broken up the same way, but I think it was always broken up. Okay. Now, all right, so that was the question that Rashi was bothered by. Why do we have Miriam and the Maram next to each other without Karach being next to Miriam? And the answer is, because if you would have had Karach, Miriam, Meraglim, you would have thought it's just a chronological order. But now that it's Miriam, Meraglim, Karach, now we know that the Torah specifically wants the story of the Meraglim next to Miriam to bring in this idea. This idea that the Meraglim saw what happened to Miriam, they should have learned from it, and they didn't learn from it. But if you would have had it following the regular chronological order, you wouldn't have able, you would have just said the Torah is following the order. Now that the Torah takes it out of order and leaves Miriam and the Meraglim next to each other, that's to bring out this special connection between the story of Miriam and the story of the Meraglim. That's one explanation that's brought down. The other explanation that is brought down as to what is bothering Rashi . See, I forgot to bring up Mekarsh Gabaylos Chemish, so it just escaped me right now. Okay, can't remember. Maybe it'll come back to me. But right now, there was another explanation that the Siddur Chacham gave. Can't remember it right now. Okay. Now, let me just focus a little bit on this this Rashi in itself. Okay, so now we know what was bothering Rashi, and the point was that the Meraglim saw what happened to Miriam, and they didn't take any kind of lesson from it. They should have taken a lesson from it. If they would have taken a lesson from Miriam, they wouldn't have spoken the Lashon Hara against the land of Israel that they did. What is the point of this? What is the lesson we're supposed to take out of this? Are we just talking about how bad the Meraglim are? What is this lesson that is being taught to us from what happened, that the Meraglim saw what happened and did not learn from Miriam? What are we to take out of it?
You could also say they were foolish. They saw her punished.
But what's the point of that? That's the thing. What's the point of saying, look, they should have. They saw what happened and they didn't learn from it? And the answer is going to be that you could have a person see something very clearly and still going to ignore it. Okay, it's very interesting. The wording is "Rishayim halalu ra'uv leilak chumusar." They saw, they didn't take a lesson. You know, it could have just as well have just said, "And these evil people didn't take a lesson. Miriam was punished, and they didn't take a lesson from it." But the wording that Rashi brings down, which is a medrash. The wording is they saw it and they didn't take the lesson. It was very clear to them what happened here. The same way the Torah tells us straight out what happened to Miriam, that she was punished for speaking against Moshe. Everybody knew that. So they saw it in front of their eyes that Miriam was punished for her speaking Lashon Hara. And as the Rambam points out, there were so many mitigating factors to Miriam speaking against her brother Moshe, that in no way was she really trying to hurt him. Moshe wasn't insulted. Miriam had loved him so much. It's not like when we speak Lashon Hara about someone and still Miriam was punished. How much more do we have to learn from that? But the point is that they saw what happened to Miriam. They saw the detrimental effect of Lashon Hara and they didn't learn from it. You know what the lesson from that is? Is that there are times where something can be so clear to you, but you're still going to ignore it. And I've mentioned this story before. There's a story, I don't know if I have all the details right, but the punchline you'll get, that basically there was a rabbi riding in a taxi in Eretz Yisrael, and the taxi drivers in Eretz Yisrael seemed to have many, many interesting stories to share. And this taxi driver said to the rabbi, told that he believes in God because of a story that happened. What happened? Him and his friends, probably after they finished their time in the army, they went traveling, and they landed up somewhere in some, you know, jungle or wherever it was in Southeast Asia. And they were sleeping in their tent one night when the taxi driver said he woke up and he heard his friend making these crazy sounds. And when he turned around, he saw that a giant snake had wrapped itself around his friend and was basically choking him to death. And as much as the friends tried freeing their friend from the snake. They couldn't get off. So finally, either the person who was being choked or one of them said, you know, let's say Shema Yisrael. And they all cried out, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. The snake went off and slithered away. And the person who had been almost choked by the snake, from that point on, he went back to Eretz Yisrael, he became a Baal Tshuva, and he became fully observant. So the rabbi turned to the taxi driver and said, "Nu, and what about you?" And the taxi driver responded, "Didn't happen to me."
This is good.
There is a tendency that something could happen in front of your eyes. You know, I'm not saying it's as much as what the Meraglim saw, but they're just things that can happen in front of you and you just look away from it. So there's clearly this issue that you can see something and you should be taking the lesson from it and you still don't take the lesson from it. But are we going to say the Meraglim, like this taxi driver, they just kind of completely ignored it? Was there something going on in their mind that they should say that they could, you know, somehow or another make a difference between the two? Were they really just complete, you know, oblivion or ignoring? I mean, could you make an argument if someone were to say to you, you saw what happened to Miriam speaking Lashon Hara, don't speak Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael. Could you make an argument to make a distinction between the two? Especially when you're convinced, right? You're convinced. You know, again, the story of the Meraglim, we talk about it all the time. You know, it's not as simple as we take it, you know, there was clearly a big challenge here for them. You go into a country, you see what's going on, you see giants and people dying and everything like that, and the commentaries say they should have seen the positive of it, right? But there was clearly a lot of unusual things there. And it clearly was a challenge for them to come back with the right, with a positive report. It was a challenge. And there's really lots to talk about that. But could you make an argument if someone were to say to you, you know, you saw it to Miriam, how do you speak about Eretz Yisrael? You couldn't make an argument about it? You couldn't make a distinction?
Well, there are explanations. I suspect that not only Miriam in Israel spoke Lashon Hara.
Excuse me?
That other people at the time spoke Lashon Hara for various situations. And so they thought, well, some people get punished, some people don't get punished, and so maybe I will.
Okay, so you're saying that they're assuming other people must have spoken Lashon Hara too.
They didn't get punished.
And therefore, you know, that's Miriam and I'm me.
Yeah.
Okay, but that was a wrong calculation for some reason. Because you shouldn't think that way. All right, I was thinking that, you know, maybe you can make an argument and say, look, Miriam was rebuked for the fact that she didn't recognize who Moshe Rabbeinu was. And that could be a good argument. Look, Moshe Rabbeinu, he went up to Har Sinai and everything like that, you know. Clearly there was something unique about him. Eretz Yisrael? You know, we've heard a lot of interesting things about it. But, you know, they never were in Eretz Yisrael. They just came to Eretz Yisrael, you know. You can make a difference between saying, you know, here is, you know Moshe Rabbeinu, you know him well, right? You know him well, you see everything that's been going on with him, and you're still ready to say, what's he any different than anybody else, right? And here's Eretz Yisrael. It's a whole new situation, a whole new country, a whole new existence. There's a difference that you can maybe think, you know, there she was held responsible. But us, you know, here it is. We're in a brand new situation, and there are arguments to be made, the situation is not for us. You know, there's differences that you could possibly make. So I want to share with you a thought about, you know, again, you could always make distinctions. But what exactly should the Meraglim have learnt from Miriam to apply to themselves? Was it just a general Lashon Hara lesson? Or was there something more specific, possibly? So I want to say a very interesting mashal. And my understanding is this mashal was given to explain the sin of Miriam. And that was, there was once a king who decided that he was going to redo his palace and hire the best artists to draw different scenery all over his palace. Every wall would have a different scene of the kingdom. You would have parks, and you would have forests, and you'd have fields, and you'd have farmers working in the field. All different types of different scenery, different types of scenery in the kingdom. and they would be painted beautifully along all the walls of the palace. And when the when it was done, he invited all the people from the kingdom to come see it. After all, it was all the pictures of them. And you had artists that came, and you had laymen that came. And there was this very simple farmer who came to look at the different paintings. And as he's looking at one painting, he calls over, you know, of course, and the artists that were had done the painting, they were, you know, milling around. So this farmer, very simple farmer, who again never walked off his farm probably until he had a chance now to come, he got this invitation to come to the palace. So he calls over one of the artists and he says, "See that picture? You know, you see the picture, you have the field there, and you have this bird perched on top of a stalk of grain. It's very pretty, but a bird is too heavy to be perched on a stalk of grain. It's not going to work." And the artist says, "Okay, all right." And he said, "See that picture there? That picture there, you have a picture of a bunch of farmers. I'm not sure what the exact, I don't myself how this is supposed to look. But a bunch of farmers that are walking with a plowshare. And when farmers walk with a plowshare, they're on the right side, and you have them on the left side." So the artist was quite embarrassed, but he said, "Oh, thank you very much for pointing that out." And then there was a painting of one of the king's servants coming into the king's room and arranging things. And then the farmer says to the artist, "And you see that picture there? The picture of the servant in the king's room?" And he's about to make a comment. And the artist says, "Wait a minute. Wait one second. You want to talk to me about what happens in a field? Okay, that's one thing. Don't start criticizing and commenting on something that you have absolutely no idea about. You haven't ever even gotten off your farm till today. Now you're going to come and make comments about what goes on in the king's room with a servant?" The point by Miriam is that Miriam was able to speak about prophets. She was a prophetess, and she was able to comment about the idea that a prophet can remain married. But for Miriam to go ahead and speak about Moshe, which is what Rashi brings down, Hashem said to Miriam, "Why are you not afraid to speak about my servant, about Moshe?" So Rashi comments, doesn't say my servant Moshe. It says about my servant, about Moshe. That means if Moshe was only my servant and not Moshe, why aren't you afraid to speak about my servant? If he's my servant, it must be that someone that I appreciate. And if he wasn't my servant, it was Moshe, how come you're not afraid to speak about Moshe? The point is that Miriam Moshe is in a whole different league. You should have realized Moshe is in a different league of prophecy. Moshe is not something that you can fully grasp. He's in a whole different league. And because he's in a whole different league, you can't criticize him. You have no right to criticize him. Why are you not afraid to speak about Moshe? Moshe is such a unique individual. Moshe is in a whole different league, in a whole different sphere. Why are you not afraid to speak about him? Basically, the idea would be is that Moshe is on such a level, you don't really fully grasp what Moshe is. And that was the rebuke given to Miriam. And perhaps that's what the rebuke to the spies was. What should the spies have learned from Miriam? The spies should have learned from Miriam that when something is beyond your league, something is beyond your comprehension, something you don't have experience with, you do not go ahead and criticize that so fast. Yes, you're going to Eretz Yisrael. You don't know Eretz Yisrael. You know Eretz Yisrael is a holy land. You know Abraham Avinu desired Eretz Yisrael. Hashem promised Eretz Yisrael to the Jewish people. Eretz Yisrael is not a regular land. It's not like other lands. You want to talk about other lands? You were in Egypt. You were in the desert. You saw different places. Okay, that's one thing. But you can't talk about Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is a whole different situation. It's a whole different world. And the same way Miriam was rebuked for speaking about Moshe, who was in a different league, so to speak, they should have realized not to speak about Eretz Yisrael, because Eretz Yisrael too is in a different league.
Well, but if their reports were sort of known to before they went.
Why were they known before they went?
No, no. If there was no way for them to say anything negative,
they can come back and talk about they were given a job. Come back and tell us what's going on. But to start saying that, which they came back and they said, we could never get this place. We could never conquer this place. We are never. It's a place that kills people because everybody's dying. The point is that if you look at Eretz Yisrael like a regular like any other land, yeah, you're right. It doesn't make sense. But you should have realized from your heritage, from what the Torah has been teaching us, from what you've known, Eretz Yisrael is a different place. Why did Hashem promise it to Abraham? Because it's a unique place. Why are the Jewish people told you're going to leave Eretz Mitzrayim, you're going to get the Torah, you're going to go to Eretz Yisrael? Because Eretz Yisrael is a unique place. It's a different kind of place. You should have realized that Eretz Yisrael is beyond your comprehension. It's beyond your ability to criticize. You can go and look and report and tell us what you see. But basically not to start rendering a decision on that, how can you do that? And that's what they should have learned from Miriam. Miriam was rebuked for commenting on Moshe, who should have realized was beyond her comprehension because of who Moshe was and what she saw about Moshe. The spies should have learned from that part of Miriam that they have to be careful how they comment about Eretz Yisrael. Because Eretz Yisrael, they should have realized, is very different, is beyond what other lands are. Okay. Now, let's go back. Let's be a little further.
But of course, another argument about why Miriam was punished was that she was on a higher level and maybe mere mortal would not have been punished for that. So maybe they thought, well, we are not Miriam, therefore we are fine.
Could be. That could be, but again, yeah, it's human nature. But again, I'm trying to say what good. Those are all reasons why they could have talked it into themselves. I'm trying to say a little bit that what there could be a pretty. I'm trying to make a pretty direct connection. It's a pretty direct connection about what should they have taken. Now again, the connection should be to just be Lashon Hara. But on that, you could say one's Lashon Hara about a person, one's Lashon Hara about a land. Is there an exact connection? All right, maybe you know there is different ways of looking at it. Trying to make her more of a direct connection between what had happened by Miriam and what they should have directly taken from the lesson of Miriam that could have applied to them. Okay. So then the Torah goes through the names of the spies. Let's go down to Pasuk Tes Zayin, again on page 798. Eilu Shemoisa Anoshim, these are the names of the people. Asher Sholach Moshe Lasura Sa'aras, and Moshe sent out to spy the land. Vayikra Moshe Lashia ben Nun Yehoshua, and Moshe called Hoshea ben Nun Yehoshua. The spy for the tribe of Ephraim was Hoshea ben Nun, and Moshe called him Yehoshua. This is the Yehoshua, Moshe's disciple. We see from here his name was Hoshea, and Moshe added the letter Yud to call him Yehoshua. And Rashi here comments, if you take a look in Rashi, it's the top Rashi on the left column. Vayikra Moshe v'Hoshea. Hispalel Olav. Moshe Rabbeinu prayed about Yeshua. Ka Yoshiacha me'atzas meraglim. God should save you from the plan of the spies. The letter Yud represents the name of Hashem, Ka. And by saying Yud Hoshea, Ka Hoshea, Hashem should save you. Save you from what? From the plot of the spies. Moshe Rabbeinu really sensed that the rest of the spies were already on a negative path, and he prayed for Yeshua, Ko Yeshiach Hashem should save you from joining up with the plan of the spies. I want to share with you two comments on this. One comment is from Rabbi Friend, from his Rebbe, Rabbi Moshe Kalevsky, that's all. And there's a lot of parts about this question that I'm not so comfortable with, but I will explain the question as best as I understand it, because I really like the answer. The answer has a very strong lesson in it. So, again, connecting last week's parasha. Last week's parasha, Moshe says to the Rebbe Shalalem, I can't carry the load by myself, I need help. Hashem says, okay, you'll take 70 elders, and you'll get a prophecy, then they'll prophesize, they're going to be your aides, your assistants. And the Torah tells us there were two people named Eldad Umedad, we spoke about it last week, that were supposed to be from the 70, they didn't go. And instead of going to the Mishkan to prophesize, they remained in the camp by their tents and they prophesized there. And it says that a lad came and told Moshe that Eldad Omeidim Misnabim Machana, Eldad Omeidim are prophesizing in the camp. And when Yehoshua hears this, he says, Adoni Moshe Kloim, imprison them. There's something wrong. They need to be imprisoned and investigated. What was the problem here? So Rashi tells us, the big problem Yehoshua had with Eldad Omeidim were the fact as to what they were prophesizing about. They were prophesizing, Moshe Meis, Moshe will die, the Yehoshua Nechmas L'Eretz Yisrael, and Yehoshua is going to enter the land of Israel. They were prophesizing Moshe's demise, that he would not enter Eretz Yisrael, and Yehoshua would be the leader to lead the Jewish people into Eretz Yisrael. And it seems that when Yehoshua heard that, he said to Moshe, made a claim, imprison them, there's something wrong with that. Now, what exactly was bothering him? So, the assumption of the way Rabbi Fran brings it down, is the assumption is that Yehoshua could not fathom that he would be the leader in place of Moshe. He had a problem with that. He could not accept that he would be the one to replace Moshe, and therefore he assumed that there's going to be something wrong here. Here they are supposedly prophesizing, it can't be, doesn't make sense. Moshe tells Yehoshua, you know, if only everybody would be prophets. Now what exactly Moshe Rabbeinu's response is a separate discussion. But Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't seem to be like denying it. So that's that story. You have Yehoshua, when he hears Eldad Omeidim prophesizing he's going to be next, Moshe's not going to lead them into Israel, he's going to lead them? Preposterous. Can't be. Something wrong with them. Check them out. And Moshe says, so they can be prophets.
Exactly,
excuse me?
What did Moshe exactly say?
Moshe just said, basically, if only everybody would be a prophet. Okay, that's last week's
parasha. Avoided the answer.
Yeah. I don't think he avoided the answer. He meant to say, again, it really depends what the problem was. Okay. I mean, last week when we spoke about this and when I was, you know, preparing, I did not understand that Yehoshua had a problem with him becoming the leader, as much as the fact that they were saying it. How do they say it in public? It was disrespectful to Moshe. They had no right to prophesize where they were prophesizing. It wasn't so much about him. But again, the way he seems to lay it out is that Yeshua's problem with what they said, Yeshua's challenging that maybe they're being false prophets, was this idea that Moshe should die and he's going to take his place. Based on that, the question is, why was Moshe afraid that Yeshua should join the spies? The Zohar says, a famous Zohar, that says that when the spies came back with a negative report, the Zohar and many commentaries aren't ready to take the spies, who are all very great men, and just basically say they walked into Eretz Yisrael, they looked at it, and they said, no way. They're not ready to do that. There was something subconscious, something deep inside their psyche that was playing with them, that was working at their perception, that was influencing their perception about what was going on. And the Zohar says that the spies were afraid that when Klal Yisrael would enter Eretz Yisrael, and basically everything would now be on a higher level, that they would lose their positions. They were princes, they were given their positions in the desert when the Jewish people were at a certain level. But when you go into Eretz Yisrael and the level is a higher level, they're not going to be worthy of keeping their positions. And because of the fact that deep down they didn't want to lose their positions, which they expected to happen when they entered Eretz Yisrael, that tainted their perception, that tainted their perception of what was going on, and therefore they came back with a negative report. So deep down the problem was this fear. Assuming that Moshe understood, when Moshe already sensed that the spies had bad intentions, and assuming that Moshe understood what was the basis for those bad intentions, why would he be afraid Yehoshua would want to join? Yehoshua is not the kind of person who's worried about positions. He's not the kind of person. Yehoshua is very humble. He's so humble that he wouldn't even believe a possible prophecy that he should be the one entering. So Yehoshua is going to be the one that's going to be concerned about losing his position when he enters Eretz Yisrael? Now I can say there's a difference between becoming the leader of the Jewish people and keeping your position. I can hear there's a difference. But that seems to be the question. So Rav Kalevsky Zatzal shared with him a thought from the Kuznetzer Maggid. The Kuznetzer Maggid explained that the problem was like this. Yes, Yeshua was very humble. And he was so humble that he couldn't fathom that Moshe should die and that he should take over. And perhaps that would taint his perception. Because of the fact that he couldn't fathom that he would be the leader, but he heard the prophecy. And Moshe Rabbeinu didn't deny the prophecy. So Yeshua sees his prophecy that he is going to be the next leader. But in his humility, he can't deep down accept that. And perhaps that would taint his perception. Meaning, he would join with the spies to discourage the Jewish people from going to Eretz Yisrael. And he would join the spies, discouraging, the same way the spies would discourage, but the motivation would be different. Their motivation was covet. Their motivation was honor. His motivation was, not me, I don't deserve this. I can't be the next leader. Moshe was afraid that his humility, that wasn't allowing him to accept the idea that he would be the next in line, that would taint his perception. He would join with the spies and say Eretz Yisrael is not a good place to enter, but not because he doesn't want to lose his position, he doesn't want to gain his position. That's why Moshe had to daven on behalf of Yeshua. And there's actually commentaries that say that the reason why Moshe prayed for Yeshua was because of his, I think the Targum of Ben Uziel says, when Moshe saw how humble Yeshua was, he prayed for him, Hashem should save you. So all the commentaries say, what's the connection? According to this, it's a very good connection. The connection is that the same way the minds of the spies are tainted because of the honor, because of the status of afraid they're going to lose, Yeshua could be tainted because of his humility. And Refrain points out a very good, very interesting point. Yeshua's humility was real, was sincere, was a good trait. It's the highest trait you could have. But even a positive trait can sometimes go wrong. Even a positive trait, you have to be careful. It shouldn't steer you in the wrong direction. Nothing is free of challenge. Even a positive trait like profit, like humility, could possibly steer you in the wrong direction. Because if the humility is basically saying to you, it can't be that I deserve this kind of position, and now because of that, it taints your perception and it actually blurs your perception, that means a positive trait went wrong. You took the prophecy too far. You took it in the wrong direction. That's a very powerful lesson. The Chafetz Chaim also deals with this question about, deals with this whole topic about Moshe praying on behalf of Yeshua. And the Chafetz Chaim asks, you know, we know at the end it was Kalev and Yehoshua that protested against the spies. Why did Moshe only daven for Yeshua, not for Kalev? Later on in the Parsha, we find that Rashi brings down that when the spies came to Hebron, Kalev snuck away, and he went and he prayed by Maris HaMachpelah, by Avram Yitzchak and Yaakov, that he should be saved from his friends. He should not join up with his friends. So why did Kalev do it and Yeshua not do it? Later on in the Parsha, the spies come back with their report, and Kalev gets up and protests on his own. Yehoshua and Kalev then later on protest. And Hashem gives Kalev a special reward for his protesting. Not Yehoshua, Kalev. I mean, Yehoshua also protested. So why didn't Yehoshua get anything special? Now maybe you'll say because he didn't speak up like Kalev did. Kalev spoke up first. So the Chafetz Chaim says a fascinating idea. He says that if an individual finds himself amongst a group of evildoers, okay, and he clearly doesn't want to join them in what they're doing, he doesn't want to participate in what they're doing, but what's he supposed to do in that situation? What's the right way to go? So the truth is, as the Chafetz Chaim, there's two ways to go, two acceptable ways to go. One way would be, what do you think one way would be?
Well, the Kalev, to say strongly.
To stand up right away, stand up, And protest. Yeah, you're amongst these people, right? You're clearly the minority, but you should be. You'll be a vote. You'll get up and not be afraid, and right away speak up against them and speak to them and against them, making it clear to them you're not with them. The Chafetz Chaim says there's another approach, and the other approach is that you know you're gonna play along for a while. You're gonna play along, maybe amongst yourselves, you'll play along. And when you go public, that's when you're going to come up. That's when you're going to come out and speak against what's going on. You're basically going to buy yourself time so that you actually will get the possibility, you'll have the opportunity of when this goes public, that they won't be ready for you not to go public. You'll basically surprise them and publicly speak out against them. So the Chabad Chaim says there's a valid way of death. That's also a valid approach. That was Kalev's approach, he says. Kalev's approach was to start off in a way that the spies did not know that he was not with them. As a matter of fact, the Torah says that when your Kalev got up to speak, it says, Kalev silenced everyone. And Rashi says, how did he silence everyone? He got up and he said, is this the only thing Moshe did to us? Oh, and everybody listened up. He says, he took us out of Egypt. He split the Red Sea, you know. But the Chafetz Chaim says that Kalev was able to do that because all the other spies thought he was on their side. That really gave the opportunity that he could get up and no one's going to stop him from doing it. Yeshua, on the other hand, Chafetz Chaim says, was right away in the beginning. He was open with his friends, with the other spies. I'm not going along. I'm not going along. And the Chafetz Chaim says, each one has its asset, each one has its chesaron, each one has a danger to it. The person who's vocally speaking out right away, what's everybody else going to do to him? They're going to work very hard to silence him. They could hurt him. They could kill him. They could do something to him to stop him from speaking. Okay? The other one, although the Kalev approach, which is to go along, okay, he'll be safe until he has his chance to get up and speak. However, he's spiritually in danger. Because the more you go along, the more you act as you're going along, the more possible it's going to be. You're going to get influenced. You're going to buy into it. When you're playing along and you're not speaking out against it, there's more of a chance it's going to influence you as time goes on. So Kalev understood. So Yeshua, he faced a danger. He needed to be saved from the other spies because Moshe Rabbeinu knew he was going to be speaking out against him right away. Right away, he was in danger. So Moshe prayed for him and said, "Kal Yeshayacha, Hashem should save you." Because he right away needed to be saved from the other spies who could possibly try to harm him because he is clearly not with them. Kalev didn't need that. Kalev was okay. He was safe, physically, not spiritually. And therefore, to be spiritually safe, he went to Maras HaMachpelah and he went and he davened. He went and he davened that he should be saved, that he shouldn't be influenced by the other spies. Yeshua wasn't worried about being influenced by the other spies. And therefore, he didn't go. He didn't go to Maras HaMachpelah. He already had Moshe Rabbeinu's bracha. At the end, you have, so this is the Chafetz Chaim's approach. Moshe Rabbeinu davens for Yeshua because Yeshua right away is accepting the approach of speaking out right away, making it very clear to his colleagues he's not in it with them. Therefore, Moshe prays for his physical safety. Kalev isn't physically in danger because he's choosing to go along until the right time comes. But he faces a spiritual danger. Because he's faced a spiritual danger, therefore, he didn't get that bracha. He didn't get the bracha to be saved from that. But he went and he prayed in Maras HaMachpelah that he be saved.
But it almost should have been the other way around.
Why?
Because Moshe should have been worried about him to do the right thing. If he is with them, he will influence by them.
So why wasn't Moshe, why didn't Moshe give a bracha for that?
Yeah.
That's what you're asking. Okay. The Chafetz Chaim does not seem to address that. The Chafetz Chaim puts Yeshua in one approach, Kalev another approach. Each approach is acceptable. Each one has its dangers. Each one has its safeties. And the danger that Yeshua was physical, therefore Moshe prayed for him. Kalev was spiritual. He went to Maras HaMachpelah.
Yeah, but traditionally the Jews worry about spiritual degradation much more than physical.
Okay. So, Rav Nissen Kaplan, who was Rosh Shiva in Eretz Yisrael, so the way he says it, even though the Chafetz Chaim doesn't say it, but the way he says it is, if you need to be saved spiritually, you have to pray yourself. You got to do it yourself.
Interesting.
You can't rely on a tzaddik's bracha. You can't rely on Moshe. Basically, Moshe Rabbeinu was saying for Kalev, I can't daven for you. I can't do for you what I did for Yeshua. For Yeshua clearly did something big. He changed his name. That form of prayer was a very big blessing. It was something very real, right? You know, did Moshe Rabbeinu daven for Kalev? Maybe he did. You can daven for some of spirituality, but you can't go as far when someone has to deal with a spiritual challenge as you can when he has to deal with a physical challenge. When dealing with a spiritual challenge, it has to come from him. He's got to do it. Therefore, Yeshua Kalev went to Maaseh Machpelah. Yeah, you can pray for yourself, that's for sure. That's part of your efforts. But Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't do for Kalev what he did for Yeshua, because for your spiritual safety, that has to primarily come from you. Can't come from a tzaddik's bracha. So Rabbi Kaplan brings down something very interesting. He brings down that Rabbi Moshe Sternbach from Eretz Yisrael said that Rabbi Chana Vassar Mezatzal, who was Rashiva, the Branovich Yeshiva before World War II, he was at Rabbi Moshe Sternbach's originally from London. Or at one time he lived in London. Must have been young, must have been a kid then. Yeah, he was a child, he was in London. And Rabbi Chana Vassarman came to London, and basically he was an orphan, and his mother begged Rabbi Chana Vassarman to bless her children, that her children should become great in Torah and fear of Hashem. Right? That's a very sincere thing to do, for a mother to do. Rabbi Chana Vassarman responded that he has a tradition from the Chafetz Chaim that for ruchnius, for spiritual accomplishments, brachas don't help. You got to put in the work, and you got to daven with all your strength, and without that, a bracha is not going to help. So he wouldn't give a bracha, okay, he wouldn't give a bracha because he says you need toil, you need hard work, you need effort, you need your own prayers. And we're just reading the words here, and without effort and without prayer, no bracha can help. So without the effort, he wouldn't give a bracha.
So he said that is the tradition from Chafetz Chaim?
Yes.
But I thought you told us a few minutes ago that Chafetz Chaim doesn't address that.
Not in what I saw.
Not in there, okay.
Not in the source that I was looking at.
Okay.
And then he said, Rabbi Nissen Kaplan tells his own story. His father took him to Rav Shach for a brach, took him to Rav Shach before his bar mitzvah. Rabbi Nissen when he was a young bacher, you know, what bracha would you like? He brought him for a bracha. So he said, what bracha do you want? What blessing do you want? He said, I want a bracha to be a Talmud Chacham. Rav Shach responded, can't give a bracha for that. For that, you got to work. You got to toil, and you'll for sure become a Talmud Chacham. So Rabbi Kaplan is applying that to here too. You know, here was not a question of learning Torah, but it was about, again, dealing with a spiritual danger. So I'm not going to say, I will take liberty to suggest that perhaps there is a place for bracha that a person should be saved from a spiritual danger. But Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't do what he did for Yeshua. The level that he did for Yeshua, which was change his name, right, really do something big as a prayer and blessing for Yeshua, he couldn't do that for Kalev. Because Kalev, it had to come from Kalev himself. Okay. I want to tell you a different story. And I cannot verify the story. But I have heard this story. Have you ever met Rabbi Beer's brother, Rabbi Meir Beer from B'nai Brak? Okay. So Rabbi Beer himself comes from a place called Elizabeth, New Jersey, if you haven't heard that yet. Has he told you that? Yeah, I'm also from Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
Okay. He's a little older than me. We used to see each other a little bit, but we both went to the same yeshiva in Elizabeth, in elementary school. Just that when Rabbi Beer and his brother was there, it was much smaller. So one of the Rabbeim, I forgot his name, I can't remember his name, one of the Rabbeim, who was this Meir Beer's Rebbe, took his class to meet Rabbi Aaron Kuppler. And when they met Rabbi Aaron Cutler, so Meir Beer asked his Rebbe, ask the Rosh Hashiva, I want a bracha to become a Talmud Chacham. So at some point, I don't know if it was under pressure or what, but the Rebbe, I think Rabbi Aaron asked him, what did the boy ask for? And I hesitated. Finally, he told him, he says, he wants a bracha to be a Talmud Chacham. So Rabbi Aaron said, can't give a bracha to be a Talmud Chacham. You got to learn to be a Talmud Chacham. So the Rebbe told Meir Beer what Rabbi Aaron said. And he got very agitated. And he said, tell the Rashiv, I want to be a Talmud Chacham. I want to be a Talmud Chacham. And Rav Aaron was so moved by his strong desire to be a Talmud Chacham, he gave him a bracha to be a Talmud Chacham. This story relates to that also. There is this idea, you know, that there can be brachas for other things. You get a bracha blessing from a great person for many things.
So wait.
But when it comes to your spiritual growth, that has to come from your efforts and from your toil.
So why did you say you couldn't verify it? We can go and ask Rabbi Bier.
You could. I didn't verify it recently.
I will ask that.
I didn't verify recently. I don't remember who I heard the story from. But I remember such a story.
That's a good story.
Yeah. Okay.
He visits here once a year. So
yeah. Okay. The next thing. Let's go a little further.
He's very friendly with my brother back in...
Oh, Bnei Brak? Okay. Now, take a look on page 800. Pasuk Chaf Vav. Pasuk reads, Vayelchu... So this is... Actually, look at Pasuk Chaf Hei. Vayashuv mitur haaretz. The spies returned from spying the land... Miketz Arboyim at the end of 40 days. Vayelchu, and they went. Vayavoyu, and they came. El Moshe al Aaron to Moshe and to Aaron. V'chaladas b'nei Yisrael and to the entire assembly of the Jewish people. And they brought back the report. Now Rashi is bothered by the fact that it said, the Pasuk Chaf read, they returned from spying the land. And then Pasuk Chaf says, and they went and they came to Moshe. Take out the word Vayelchu, and they went. They returned from flying the land, and they came to Moshe. Why does it say, and they went, and they came? Says Rashi, because from this Gemara in Saita, Vayelchu Vayavoyu is really coming to teach us the following idea. That the same way that they came, with the same intentions that they came with, those were the intentions that they went with. They came back with the intentions of disparaging the land, and when they first left, they had those intentions also. Right away, there was something there in their minds. Right and where, there was something there within the spies that was already there saying that they are out, they are at, they, that they are not going to be in favor, that they're out to disparage the land, that this is not the land that they want. So all the commentaries ask that this would seemingly contradict something that we had back on page 798, Pasuk Gimel. There the Pasuk reads, Vayishlacha Samayisha Mimar Paran Al Pi Hashem. Moshe sent them from the desert of Paran by the command of God. Kulam anashim, all of them men. What does that mean? So Rashi says, kulam anashim, the word anashim means, the word anashim, kulam anashim, kol anashim shemir kolashim chashilis. Anytime the word anashim is used, it means people of stature. Vo'isa shok sherim hoyu. At that time, they were still kosher. At that time, they were still righteous. So here, Rashi's telling us, when it says Moshe sent them, which is Moshe was appointing them, they were anashim, they were ksherim, they were kosher, they were still righteous. So, and here, and then later, Rashi says, no, even when they went, even to begin with when they went, they already were soured.
Well, plus they, is all of them, we know that at least two.
Yeah, but that's always. Because Anashim was all of them here too. Okay. So that's the contradiction that there is. So the commentary of the Marsha in Masechta Saita, which is what Rashi brings down, that they already had bad intentions to begin with. The Marsha says that here, in the beginning of the Parsha, when they were appointed to be spies, they were righteous. But once they left on their mission, they had soured. So within a very short period of time, things changed. When they were appointed to be the spies, they were still righteous.
Okay.
Once they left, once they went on their mission, that's when things soured.
But weren't they appointed to be spies after the Miriam story?
Yeah, they were. But at one point, their intentions were still good. But once they left on the mission, then already their intentions went bad.
Well, but the Miriam story happened earlier, so they should have learned something.
For sure they should have learned something. I'm not sure it's bothering you. They should have learned eventually when their intentions changed. Those intentions should not have changed. because of what they learned by Miriam. But at the beginning, they were okay. At the beginning, even when they were first, it would seem that even when they were first appointed to be spies, they were still righteous. They were not having bad intentions. They were out to go and fulfill their mission as spies as Moshe wanted them to. But very quickly, apparently, very soon, things changed. Because it wasn't just when they entered the land, when they first left already. It seems they already had the negative intentions about what they're going to come back with.
But then the explanation of them using the status, I don't see how that works.
I'm sorry, what's bothering you?
Well, they couldn't have...
You know what the Zohar says?
Yeah, they couldn't have not worried about losing their status
before,
and all of a sudden started worrying.
Okay. Well, let's see. Let's first understand, how do we understand this quick change? Okay. So when I saw the Maharsha, I kind of thought that the idea is like this. You know, it's like theory and practice. In theory, they're being told, go look at the land. Okay, we're going to look at the land. We're going to do what Hashem wants. We're going to do what Moshe wants. We're going to go, and we know it's a holy land, and we're going to do what we're supposed to do. No preconceived notions. No biases. But once you like get into it, once you start, even once you just start on the job, and now the job becomes real, then already things can change. Then you start thinking about like what's going to be, what's it going to look like, and maybe then, you know, clearly there were two outlooks here. Moshe, who want them to go look at the land and come back with it, we're talking about how great the land is. And the Jewish people, who you know, came asking for the spies with a whole different attitude, about an attitude like, no, maybe this place isn't for us. So at first they were influenced by Moshe, but then maybe when it came down to getting to work, then already they started thinking more like when things were going to get real and they have to really go look at it. Then everybody they started thinking more like the Jewish people were thinking. The attitude changes when things get more practical. Perhaps. But let me tell you how the Maharal says it. The Maharal says it very interestingly. The Maharal says that Ba'isa Shok Sheirim Hayu, at that at the beginning they were still righteous, Avol Bishanishlahu, but once they were sent, Hayu Shluchayim Shal Rashayim, they became the messengers of evil people, Lamdimasayim, they learned from their actions, the Nasu Kamay Mishalchim Atzbam. And they became like those who sent them. When they were appointed, they were kosher. But once they were appointed, they immediately became wicked. So the Maharal is saying that as they were being appointed, meaning before they were appointed, they were righteous. But once they were officially appointed, and they officially became messengers, they became messengers of whom? The Jewish people. The Jewish people's attitude was not a good attitude. And once they became the messengers of the wicked, they learned from their actions. They became influenced from them. Just taking the words right now. The words of the Maharal are that before, as we were being appointed, they were fine. But once they were appointed as messengers, and they became the messengers of the Jewish people, that's how they saw themselves, and the Jewish people's intentions were not proper, that immediately had an effect on them and it influenced them. How do we understand that? So I heard a very interesting explanation from Rabbi Daniel Glatstein. And he said this from his Rosh Hashiva, B'penach Klibu Etzatzal. And if I understand, the way I understood the answer is that here we have an example of a good trait going wrong. The trait here that the spies were actually manifesting was loyalty. They were the messengers of these people. And as messengers of these people, a sense of loyalty is that if you're doing a job for someone, you do it for them the way they want it. They want you to perceive something in a certain way, you're going to perceive it. If their attitude about Eretz Yisrael was, you know, we got to check out this land and see, can we really deal with it? Can we really conquer it? If that is their attitude, it may not be a positive attitude, it may be a wrong attitude. But now that they are the agents for them, they're working for them, loyalty, their sense of loyalty basically influenced them that they should now follow how the people who sent them out should think. It made their loyalty made them start thinking in the way that those who sent them out were thinking.
But Moses sent them out.
So did the Jewish people. They saw themselves as the messengers of the Jewish people. True, they should have seen themselves as messengers of Moshe, but they saw themselves as messengers of the Jewish people too. And as messengers of the Jewish people, there was a certain sense of loyalty that said that if I am doing something for them, I should be doing it for them the way they want me to do it. And therefore, although loyalty is a trait that could stem from truth, from truthfulness, from emes, and it's a very positive trait, but again, it's a positive trait that can go wrong if you don't keep it in check. That's how Rebbe Henoch wanted to explain it. This idea that once they became the messengers, they were influenced, they learned from their evil ways, was really a manifestation of their loyalty to the people they were working for. They saw themselves working for the Jewish people, and the loyalty within them to that said, we need to be approaching it like the Jewish people see it. And that influenced them, of course, in a negative way. Good night, everyone. Thank you very much. Catch my eye.